Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California and the Bay Gourmet Forum. And I am Judy Tisdale, a member of the Bay Gourmet Forum's Planning Committee. The program is also part of the Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's my pleasure to introduce Chef Yotam Ottolenghi, Israeli-born chef, cookbook author, and restaurateur. He and his business partner, Sammy Tamimi, own four Ottolenghi restaurants slash cafe slash takeout shops in London, and in addition, the restaurant Nopi, a brasserie open all day. He's the author of two cookbooks, Plenty. I have it. It's fabulous. He didn't ask me to say that. Plenty and the new book, Jerusalem, which is co-authored with Sammy Tamimi, his business partner. Both books share Ottolenghi's delicious recipes and are, as members of the audience have already shared with me, and I agree, just visual treats. They are just gorgeous, and the recipes deliver. So please welcome Chef Yotam Ottolenghi. Thank you.
Oh, I don't know if I need that.
I don't think you need that. I did.
If you don't mind my saying so, we have found some copies of Jerusalem, the Taste of Jerusalem, is it? Thank you.
Hi. It's only in America that they call you chef all the time, so I slightly get a little bit paranoid when they say chef, because I never know anybody ever calls me by that term, so here I am. I have to start with two apologies. First of all, I am slightly less comfortable with this talk today because I've had Sammy with me for the last couple of weeks. We've been promoting our book, Jerusalem, and this is the first event that I'm doing on my own. So Sammy went back to London. He's teaching, and I'm here. So I'll try to be as comfortable as I can. But if you see me sort of becoming all shy all of a sudden, it's because Sammy's not. And the other thing is that I'm doing an event at the moment in Napa Valley. It's this Culinary Institute of America, the CIA. They're running a weekend with chefs from all over the world. And I have spent the whole day in the kitchen, which people that know me will tell you hardly ever happens. So I'm a little bit exhausted. And that would be another excuse. So now that all the excuses are out of the way, I can start talking. I want to tell you about the project, which is called Jerusalem, which I've written together with Sammy Tamimi, the elephant in the room. And Sammy and I have written this book over the last couple of years. And in order to explain the book, I need to tell a little bit about our history and about what brought us to work on that book. Sammy and I were both born in Jerusalem 40-something years ago. And we were born on the same year. Sammy was born on the Arab-Palestinian side, and I was born on the Jewish side. And in a way, our lives ran in parallel for very long. So first we were born in the same year, then we both moved from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv in the same year in the 90s, and then we were both moved to London in 1997. But it was only 2 years later that we actually met each other. It was in a place where Sammy worked as a chef, and I applied for a job as a pastry chef, and I came in with my CV in hand and, quite nervous. And Sammy was the only person of authority in the restaurant or in the cafe, and I said, I'd like to leave my CV here because I want to be a pastry chef in this place. And he said to me, well, just give it to me. I'll give it to the manager when she comes back. And we just got talking a little bit, and we were teased about London and food and this and that. And after about 10 minutes of an idle chat, we realized that actually we were speaking in the wrong language because we didn't need to speak English. We could have spoken Hebrew. And we realized that we were born in the same year, in the same city, and had lived those sort of parallel lives that there was really almost there's something a bit spooky about it, because you know there were so many points where we could have or should have or might have met, but this never happened. So we met in London, and I eventually got the job, and we worked side by side. He was running the kitchen, I was running the pastry kitchen in the same place for a couple of years. And then in 2001, I left and joined up with another friend to set up Ottolenghi, which is the business that got the ball rolling and the reason why I'm here. So Sammy joined us a few months later, and we started cooking together and creating what it is that is now sustains us. And basically, we were doing, I don't know how many of you have been to London or been to Ottolenghi, and probably some of you have not, and it, basically what it is that we create wonderfully delicious food every day using fresh ingredients and presenting it in quite a sort of flamboyant way, a lot of color and a lot of contrasts with, it's very vibrant, it's very delicious to look at and to taste. We use a lot of spices and herbs, and this is our signature, this kind of style of presenting food and eating. It's got lots of ingredients that are based on where we come from the Eastern Mediterranean, Turkish, Lebanese, Egyptian, North African, Israeli, Palestinian, also some Asian flavors on occasion, and this is what we've been doing for the last 10 years, exactly 10 years since we started. Sami and I published one book in 2008, which is the Ottolenghi Cookbook, which some of you may have read, but it has never been published in an American edition. It's only been published in Europe or in the UK, but it will be published late next year in cups and ounces. So all of you who are illiterate in grams, there is going to be a solution for that. We have written that book. It was very successful. It was a bestseller. And then a couple of years later, I wrote Plenty, which is a book that has been published in America, in an American edition, and was a bestseller. It's a vegetarian cookbook. And a couple of years ago, our business partner Noam said to Sammy and to me, "Why don't you write a book about Jerusalem?" And we looked at him quite sort of skeptically. We said, "Well, why would we want to do that?" Because you know, Jerusalem, for those of you who don't know, it's a little insignificant place in the Middle East. And those who have got a clear mind, at the age of 18, they run away because it's not somewhere you want to stay for the rest of your life. All the cool people live in Tel Aviv. And in Jerusalem is Orthodox and weirdos and, you know, all sorts of people. At that age, you really don't want to stay there. It's a place you want to probably escape. But I'm being a bit sort of provocative in what I'm saying, but it is true in many ways that young people want to leave Jerusalem and move to places that are not so deeply steeped in history, because history in that part of the world could be quite agonizing, because it's a reason for conflict and it's a reason for wars and it's a reason for people, you know, just not engaging in just enjoying life rather than, you know, history can be quite difficult. And so, you know, we both moved to Tel Aviv thinking, you know, why would we, you know, we would never go back to write anything about this thing. But Noam was right, because we said, okay, let's see what comes out of this exercise. And we sat, Sammy and I, one afternoon, I remember in his house, and we started writing down ideas. What would we like to include in that hypothetical book? It was about over two years ago. And we started reminiscing, you know, talking about like little places that we used to go to and eat falafel after school, and the whole experience of sort of getting this thing and, you know, eating when you know you shouldn't, because your mom's going to be upset because you're not going to be hungry enough for lunch, and then it drips all over your shirt, so it's all obvious that you had it. And we realized that we had very similar food experiences growing up, despite the fact we were growing in two very different parts of the city. And we actually started to enjoy this, you know, the whole idea of going back and looking at all those intricate ingredients and recipes that we haven't tasted for so many years, and talking about, you know, in Ottolenghi, if you haven't been, we don't serve hummus or falafel or anything like those things. It's a sort of more sophisticated in our eyes, you know, in our prejudiced eyes. And in some ways, going back and looking at all those basic recipes and basic techniques and flavors that are very familiar but we sort of haven't tasted for many years was a real inspiration. All of a sudden, there was some reason for us to start writing a new book, because we went back to revisit all those old flavors. And when you reach our old age, you become a little bit nostalgic about it. You know, you go like, oh, actually, you know, it's quite nice to go back 25, 30 years and sort of look back at places that you haven't visited for so long. So it became a very pleasurable experience writing that book. And it didn't happen in one day. It took a couple of years, and it took a couple of years because, for many reasons, I mean, we're both obsessive recipe checkers, so, you know, a recipe is not done until it's been tried and tested a million times by us, by other people, etc. But this was a little bit more complicated than that. To get this book done, we also had to justify our selection of recipes, and that was the difficult bit, because Jerusalem is... it's a cliche, but it's a melting pot of cultures, quite literally. There is a very, very long Arab tradition of cooking that has very deep roots in local culture, and Palestinian food. And Palestinian food is not one thing. There's Egyptian influences and Turkish influences and Iraqi and Indian. So when you break it up, there is quite a lot of subcultures and sub-cuisines within Arab food in Jerusalem. And then there is the food of all the Jewish communities, people who came over from the Middle East or North Africa or the Balkans or Spain or Eastern Europe or so many places. And each one has their own food identity and food culture. So when we started writing the book, it was apparent after not a very long period that we would never be able to cover all grounds. We would never be able to write the ultimate, you know, Jerusalem cookbook that covers all communities and all cultures. It's the sort of project that Claudia wrote, and if you know her, takes on and does over 10 years. It just wouldn't have worked. So we had to choose, and the way we chose recipes was really based on what we love eating and what we like, you know, what we cook. So it's all those wonderful Arab dishes and all the pickles and tahini over everything and sesame and halva and nuts and grapes and figs and all those things that we love cooking. It sort of doesn't represent the Ashkenazi part of this culture, because it's not, I mean, there are Ashkenazi recipes, but not many of them, because it's not what we love eating. So we made a very sort of private selection of recipes. We curated something that is very us, but wouldn't really make sense to anyone else. If you're going to call it Book Jerusalem, it has to sort of tell a wider story. So we had the recipes, the justification, but we didn't have the narrative to justify it. And this is why it took especially long, because we had to start writing stories, which are our private stories and stories of different people. And the history of the city, and that was the last element in this book, and that's where we start trying to tell a story. And the story is our private memories, things that happened to us as children, where we used to go, what we used to do, how we used to eat, stories from the city, where the little hidden gems were, what the city felt like in the 1970s and 1980s, the history of the city, of this place, which is, you know, everybody knows or think they know Jerusalem, but they know it on a very sort of superficial level. They know the history, they know some stories, they know the fact that there's a couple of nations there living side by side, not very happily, but they don't know what goes on in people's home, how they cook, what they talk about. So we try to sort of bring all that to the readers, and that was the justification to our selection, because that those stories are the stories of real people in a real place, and that's what we try to do in the book, to tell stories of ingredients, of a few people, of ourselves, and of the cities. And that's our project. And in the end, it sort of somehow worked. I think it was quite a lot of work involved, but also the fact that this is a very exciting place to eat in, and people don't really know how exciting it is to eat in, because the last thing you think about when you think Jerusalem, if you haven't been, is that it's a culinary destination. I mean, God, it's not Tokyo or Paris or New York, you know, it's Jerusalem. But it really is a culinary destination in so many ways, especially if you have access to people's homes, because people do cook the most fantastic food for different reasons. You know, there is some wonderful ingredients, but there is also the fact that it is a place where cultures meet and influence each other, food cultures. So the Palestinian food, like Lebanese food, is extremely delicious. Pulses and lamb and chicken and za'atar and cumin and lemon juice, all those kind of flavors. But when it mixes up with the Sephardi tradition of mixing meat with fruit, like in North Africa, where you might find apricot with quail, or you might find prunes with lamb, you get all those sort of amazing combinations that are really unique to that place. And when we tell our stories, that's what we try to bring to the surface, the fact that there's all these wonderful things happening in a place where people don't seem to think that there is culinary fireworks going on, but there is. There really, really is. I want to probably take questions now. I mean, if you don't have questions, I can keep on talking forever. But the one thing I also want to talk about before I take questions is Middle Eastern food. And there is this thing that I've been thinking about since I'm on a book tour. And Sammy and I were traveling for about 10 days to 2 weeks in North America, and we're asked a lot about Middle Eastern food or Eastern Mediterranean food, you know, the food of Turkey and Syria and Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, and those kind of areas. And there is a sense that this is this kind of food culture that is yet to be discovered in a sort of a serious way. That what has been done with Spanish food or Italian food or French food is, or even Greek or North African, has yet to reach that part of the Mediterranean. The fact that it's sort of an undiscovered treasure, that there is a lot to discover. And I really think that this is the case. The Eastern Mediterranean or Levantine food culture is one of the richest food cultures there is. And it developed over millennia, and it's got its own basic ingredients and techniques, and you know, it's very vibrant. It uses a lot of spices and a lot of pulses. And I think it suffers from a bad reputation because for many years, I think at least else, especially in England, kebabs were where you went to go to eat where you were a bit drunk, pissed in the middle of the night, and you know, there's nothing better to fill you up with. And that's the whole image of Middle Eastern food. Or you go to very down market sort of hummus place and you have a few mezes that are not very well thought over. But it's a very, very rich food culture. If any of you has traveled in Turkey, you would have known that there's about 70 types of kebabs with different spices, whether they've got bulgur wheat or whole wheat inside, whether there's pistachios or pine nuts, and many types of chili that go in. There's the Adana kebab, which is red and full of red spices and chilies, and there's the other kebabs. I mean, it's a whole world of for me, as multifaceted and as intricate as Italian food, but it's just that it hasn't got the recognition yet, or it hasn't been written about as much. So I'd like to just complete this part of the talk just by saying that there's that I think another aspect of this food I hope getting following in readership is hopefully to open people's eyes to Mediterranean food or Middle Eastern food, because I really think there is a lot to discover there and a lot to enjoy. And it is really way more complicated than shawarma or kebabs or doner kebab and all those things that we sort of try to make fun of when we are
cynical. But
yeah. So why don't you ask a few questions if you have any? And
I had two, actually. Okay. I've been to Israel several times, and I started in the 80s. And the first time, I don't remember the food being so startling, but...
Probably wasn't.
Yes, well, somebody, on my next time, I go volunteer, and I'm not very well off. So the second time, friends took me to a place in Caesarea. Am I saying it right?
Yeah.
It was unforgettable, plus the wine. I don't think I've had better wine. And I wondered if that's about the time when the...
food revolution started.
Thank you very much. Yes.
There's something interesting going on, and it's definitely... I've been living in London for 15 years now, so I was away from what's been happening. I go very often. I go a few times a year. But there's... When I left Israel in the mid-1990s, the food was atrocious. Not what people cooked at home and not what you had on the street, but in restaurants. So if you were a tourist visiting Tel Aviv, the service was bad and the flavors were horrible and it was just very well, very badly executed. And I don't think there was any... Nobody had the passion for food at the time. It was just something, you know, that had to be done. And I think there's something really, really amazing that has happened over the last 15 years, that you're probably what you're referring to, the real, it's a big word, but a real renaissance in food and food related to culture. Because what I think has happened, and it sounds a bit academic, but it really, it is very essential. it's very much related to food, to ingredients, to delicious things, is that all of a sudden people realize that you don't need to cook the food that your ancestors cook wherever you came from. That there's actually a very interesting food culture and ingredients that are available in Israel or in the West Bank that are completely different from anything else that people ate Jews ate wherever they came from. And I think this is how, I mean, it's still a food culture's in formation. It hasn't really taken complete shape yet, but it's all of a sudden it really has its own voice. And when you go to Israel now, you realize that they make fantastic use of all the local ingredients, like they have never done up until this revolution. And you know, you go and they do like the most fantastic things with eggplants. Like seriously, everywhere you go, there is something different done with eggplants. Very creative, very unusual. You know, fanned out on a plate like a deconstructed baba ganoush with this and that, and you know, and it is quite amazing to see what has been happening. And I think it's just the beginning. I think there's so much to explore and to still happen there. So I absolutely see where you come from and what you're describing.
Yes, and the other thought I had was that the last time I was there was in April, and friends took me to the beach in Tel Aviv. Mm. Almost every place we went, the food was unbelievable, especially in the evening when the sun was going down.
Yeah. We all want to go. Now, there's a lady there next to you.
Thank you so much for writing Plenty. It is beautiful, and every time I cook from it, people think I'm a gourmet chef. And the flavors and the spices in it are so incredible and so unique to an usual American cook.
Yeah.
Everything in it, I'm always going to the store and looking for the different ingredients, and every person I've ever cooked for, and I really do think that food is love, so when you're making food for people, they really feel it, has gone out and bought the cookbook. And I've given the cookbook to so many people before it was even available in the United States. So thank you. And especially because I am vegetarian and people always say there's not enough to eat, I always say it's plenty. And here's your new guide to it. But my question for you is about... what you're seeing in terms of being in the United States, and we have such a weird kind of thing about food, where we are so overfed and yet undernourished.
Yeah.
And I know you've been in the UK for the last 15 years, but sort of what you're seeing in terms of food in general and sort of this crazy obsession and the kind
yeah.
of...
I overly fed and undernourished is what I see when I see a Starbucks cup of coffee where it has the same amount of coffee as a double espresso in Italy, and it's got like, it seems like everything, like they've taken, I don't know if it's value for money or what it is. I mean, this double espresso is so much more delicious than that thing full of milk and no coffee flavor. I mean, sorry, I'm not here to say horrible things about America, because you know, I enjoy myself here. But there is this sense that, you know, the bigger the better, and, you know, and it's not about the flavor, it's about the quantity. And I think there's probably, and this happens all over the world, it's not just here, unfortunately, it happens everywhere, also in the UK. But I think that two trends are happening at the same time. On the one hand, you've got this idea that, you know, that there's more fast food and more big portions and more this and that. But on the other hand, you've got the opposite trend of people really seeking wonderful ingredients and making the best of it. And this, I mean, California is the place where this thing is actually happening. And, you know, I think Alice Waters has influenced all of us all over the world. So it's not just like a one-sided American thing. It's always had the other, side of it. And I honestly think that it would probably go in a better direction in the long term, because it's not sustainable. At some point, it's supposed to sort of go that way, and people will start eating more reasonably and a little bit less and with more delicious food. But the one thing I have to say about this is that I think the problem is that there is something that is also very evident in the UK, maybe even more than here, is that people are trying to teach people how to eat. And I always tend to think that this is a really bad approach, because sometimes I read in the papers or listen to the radio, and there is some sort of someone who's a sort of a professor of nutrition starting to tell people that they should sort of balance their diet and have a little bit more of this and a little bit of that, and they should eat organic, and you know, and your mind just explodes with all this information that you're supposed to act upon. You know, you should eat more fish, and you should eat less animal protein, but you should eat more vegetables. But you know, and I just think that there's a problem, because people are trying to fix people's ways rather than just show them what delicious things they can eat. And I'm really very firmly believe that food education is a very hazardous way to take. I think it's much better to create nice food, to show everybody what you can do with food, to create the beautiful dishes, celebrate food. Because unless people eat, they will never understand. And the bottom line is that if there's anything, the only way to fight these trends is just to show them that the double espresso is so much more delicious than the big cup.
Revolution.
The delicious revolution.
So that
yeah.
She really believes
you
change people by
people. Yeah, I really believe in that. I think the sense of taste is important, and you know, and people grow up and understand. But it really needs to start from tasting, and not from, you know, not from certificating, because it just doesn't work. More questions?
Hi. You talked about the influence of Alice Waters and the history of the book that you've just written. Could you talk about your history in terms of your culinary history and how you know where you were trained and how you wound up in London?
Today I was cooking with a chef who was helping me in the CIA event, and he's 32. And he said to me, "When did you start cooking?" I said, 29. He said, 29? You know, I can't believe you started at the age of 29. That's like when we retire. And because he started cooking when he was 14. And I started when I was 29. And before that, I was a failed academic. I started to, not a failed academic, I was an aspiring academic that never quite fulfilled his ambitions. I studied in university. I did a master's degree in philosophy and literature. And when I graduated, I decided I probably won't pursue this career path. So I went to the Cordon Bleu Cookery School in London. And I took two courses, not the whole diploma, but just two courses. And then I just started working in restaurants.
and cafes, and I was ancient, so I had to find I had to specialize really quickly before it was too late. So I became a pastry chef, which you can sort of, if you're 15, you can take your time and before you specialize, but if you're 29, you need to do it really quickly. So I specialized as a pastry chef, and I worked for about 4 or 5 years as a pastry chef. So most of my experience is in the pastry department. And if you, anyone of you have been to Ottolenghi knows that pastries are a substantial part of the business, and that's where I began. When we opened Ottolenghi, I started working also in the savory side. Sammy was running the savory kitchen, but we worked together a lot in terms of designing menus and so I just got experience through trying things at home. So I've never actually worked in a kitchen properly cooking food. It was always pastries, which is a little bit easier. And that's my story. It's a little bit unusual. I started writing in 2006 for The Guardian newspaper in London. This is where I became a recipe writer. It was quite weird because I never wrote a recipe before. And The Guardian asked me to write a vegetarian column for them. And I had to, I went home and I had my brief and I had to decide what I'm going to cook and I had to write the recipe. And I had no idea. And it's more difficult than you think. Because someone who cooks does one thing and someone who writes recipe does something completely different. These are sort of non-related activities. You know, testing a recipe is something that it's not so pleasurable as cooking. You know, you need to note every little thing that happens in your kitchen, whether how many seconds it was on at each stage and how many grams went into this and that. And then you need to sort of stop and wonder and not just enjoy the food, but also analyze it and realize, I think, what's going to come in next, etc. So this is how this whole thing started, from cooking to food writing, and so this is now my third book, and I feel quite comfortable writing recipes now. Yes.
I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about the Ottolenghi business model. I grew up in London, and my mother used to pick up food from Ottolenghi for us for dinner probably once a week, and we loved it. And we've since moved back to San Francisco, and my mother lives here now, and we just can't find anything that compares. There's no good really takeout food.
I beg you not to ask me to open an Ottolenghi branch in San Francisco.
I've already written to you and asked you to do that, but you didn't respond. So I just wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about why you think it's so successful in London and what's driven your business.
Why is it successful? I guess it's a few different things. First of all, really the whole Anna here, who's sitting there, can tell you she's worked for Ottolenghi for a little while, and she can tell the whole focus of my energy and Sammy's energy and Cornelia, who's the general manager and really literally runs the business, is really about creating something that is off the highest quality we can imagine. So, you know, all our love and creativity goes into that. I think this is one of the reasons why it is successful, because really there is, I don't know other business models and food business models, I know ours, and I just know that this model doesn't make sense to anyone else who's, I mean, a lot of people have looked at our business models with all kinds of ideas, but it's really all about, you know, creating impossible menus and then making them happen. And we don't work with recipe books or recipes or manuals. We work very closely with the chefs and train them and guide them and change the menus all the time and find exotic ingredients that we get from wherever we can to make it exciting. So I think it's a lot about our personal investment that is always there and is very important to us. I guess also one of the reasons why it was successful is because it's in London of all places, and you know, London used to be really bad, and it's not so bad anymore, but when we started there was really nothing like this or even close. And I think it's one thing I have to say for the Brits bless them, is that they really do love to immerse themselves in world cuisines like no other nation. You know, it's like, if I don't think this would have worked in any other European capital apart from London, because there is a real curiosity and a real, also quite a lot of sort of self-deprecation that really, I mean, obviously the food culture was not fantastic in England, but there is a, I think it goes a little bit deeper than that. It goes back to days where they were sort of almost ruling the world, and there is real interest in what goes on in other places, and I think London is one of those places that is cosmopolitan in that respect, in the fact that it actually takes in quite a lot of people, but they have them all live sort of side by side and not change so much. And I think this is one of the reasons, because London is London. I don't know. I mean, I've been asked, like you sort of gathered, I've been asked all over this, the whole of the strip, whether we're going to open an American Ottolenghi, and I said no, quite decisively. Maybe in America, I don't know. It's very hard for me to sort of imagine myself or Sammy or the people that are involved in the business to, you know, just transport ourselves here all of a sudden, run it here, because we are very controlling, and I just don't think this would be practically possible. But you know. One other thing about the Ottolenghi business model is the fact that everything is prepared daily on site. Nothing, hardly anything, is shipped from anywhere else. The bread, and apart from bread and a couple of other exceptions, we cook everything fresh on every day, and it's very hard to go wrong when you don't centralize. When there's real people, real cooks, real chefs cooking real food every day, I think that really translates into certain flavors that are, you know, it's as if you would have cooked it yourself at home. And too many businesses, or many businesses, rely on a central production unit where things are delivered or shipped, and there's not that kind of freshness that we try to keep. More questions? Two.
Will you be taking any exotic ingredients home from the U.S.? and what are they?
I haven't really immersed myself in the local cuisine yet. Unfortunately, you can ask my publisher. He's here. Every meal I've had so far almost was from my own book. So I will have to look for something. I can't say I will, but I'm sure there's something. Do you have? Can you recommend something? Ingredients. What ingredients? I know an ingredient we don't have. Baby kale, very popular in salads at the moment. Very popular. I've seen it in a few places. Yeah. But we don't have the baby variety, so we have to cook it. But it's actually really... And you can't eat it raw, what we get back home. And I like that idea of these salads with the baby kale. So I'm going to try to import it or grow it or something. Bring a bunch of kale.
I think in response to your question about kind of the business model, I think when I first went... The thing that stood out to me that was so different in London is, I think, maybe the food regulations as well, is because Ottolenghi, when you step into this, in the shop, all the food is displayed right there. And the desserts and the pastries and all the salads, it's all different levels, and you get to be right there, and you see people come in and they ooh and ah. Whereas I feel like here, a lot of things have to be set behind a glass.
Or a refrigerator.
A refrigerator, yeah. Whereas I think the special thing with Ottolenghi was, even in London, though, that it was one of the very few places that because things are rotating so quickly, because there's so, you know, things are being refreshed constantly, that we could do that.
Yeah, we did.
So you could leave it out, and because it would just be eaten so quickly. But I think that's one of the biggest things I noticed, was that it makes a huge difference when you get to see.
It's true. And also in most, I don't know any other country in the world, we're very lucky where you're allowed to do what we do. You can get away with it, you know, display food uncovered at room temperature. I know it's safe, and Anna knows it's safe, and we never had any problems. But it seems like It wouldn't be allowed here, I know for a fact, to display food like that. And, you know, it's not like, I mean, we refrigerate the meat and the fish and all the stuff that could go off, but really with vegetables, there's no reason why you should chill them. And food is so much more delicious when you eat it at room temperature rather than refrigerated. So it's aesthetically obviously more pleasing to serve, to display food like that, but it's also much more delicious not to eat from the fridge. There is any more questions? Yes.
Could I ask you a political question?
Yes.
Sorry. It intrigues me a bit that you are an Israeli from the west side and that Sammy's from the east side of Jerusalem, and I know he's not here. Is that common that there's partnerships like that?
No, it's okay. Not common at all. I mean, it's almost a miracle. This definitely not in Israel. You don't find a lot of partnerships of Jews and Arabs. It's a very unfortunate thing. Some people claim that Jerusalem is unified, but it's not really unified in the respect that the people are, you know, unified. It's not like that at all. And one of the reasons, and we have been asked this along the way, is I think that we do manage to collaborate and just have our working relationship, but also our friendship, is because we are not there, if you see what I mean. If we had lived there, I think there would have been quite a lot of more pressures on us, daily pressures, you know, of political events and all sorts of things that just happen. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we actually formed this friendship and professional collaboration, you know, somewhere else in London, because there's lots of daily challenges for Jews and Arabs living in Israel. It's never easy, and unfortunately, that the situation is not getting better, so that you don't see more of those kind of relationships or collaborations, which is really a shame, because that would have been the way to improve the situation. It's like a vicious circle, but it really is quite rare.
I think you said on NPR that hummus might be the solution to Middle East peace. Did you? I mean, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I just was wondering, just to follow up on her question, how your book, Jerusalem, is being sort of received in Israel.
Yeah. Well, you know, funnily enough, I don't think it has been received in Israel much. I mean, I've seen one article in one paper that's written about it. It hasn't been translated to Hebrew. It probably will be at some point, but that has not happened yet. So obviously it didn't get all the promotion and all the publicity that it has received here and in Europe. But I don't know. I probably will be received well. I mean, it's people like to marvel on some of these sort of miracles. But I don't know. It's very difficult to say. I'm less and less hopeful, at least not in the last few years, of things changing dramatically over there. It just seems to be really quite stagnant at the moment. So who knows? I mean, I really hope. I did say on NPR that maybe hummus will bring people together, bring peace to the Middle East. But I said it's with a very massive pinch of salt that, you know, if something will, maybe that will be the thing, because it is the thing that people really have in common. Everybody loves hummus, whether they're Arab or Jews. But it's difficult. It's not happening yet, but it might one day. I have to hope.
I was wondering if you could speak about your favorite recipes from the book.
Yeah. First of all, just before I talk about my favorite recipes, these are my favorite recipes. And the book started with about 200 recipes, and they were narrowed down to about 120 recipes, roughly. And those are recipes that both Sammy and I really, really love. They are. We never included a recipe just because it had to be there because everybody else likes it or everybody cooks it. It's only recipes that we really love. There's a few really simple recipes. That, like, there is one recipe with which I start the book, the introduction to the book. It's got a couscous, tomato, and onion. It's the simplest thing you can make. It's like children's food. And, it's, you know, it's like pasta with tomato sauce, essentially a Middle Eastern version. But what it is it is something that we sort of played around with to make something a little bit different out of it. So initially it was Sammy's version, which his mother cooked for him, was maftul, which is a kind of a Palestinian couscous, tomato and onion. My version was with Israeli couscous, again tomato and onion. My dad used to cook it for me, and we both had this experience growing up. And then when we sat together and said, oh, we have to include something like that in the book, we said, but who's going to cook a recipe that's got three ingredients? Especially not Otolenghi followers, because we always have a million ingredients in the list. So we had to do something with it. And what we did is we were talking about, and we always agreed that the best thing about this couscous were the bits that were stuck to the bottom, the mistakes. So we decided to make the mistakes the focus of this dish. So we did something that you find quite a lot in Iranian rice cooking, where you create a tzadik, which is like a burnt bit on the bottom. So we created this couscous that is really nice, but it's got a crust on the bottom where you cook, you put some oil and butter on the bottom, and you put the cooked couscous on top, and then leave it there on very low temperature to simmer and steam. And that gives that crust. So this is one of my favorite recipes in the book, not because only because it's delicious, but also because we managed to transform one thing to something else in a way that we were happy with. And that also is the case with many other recipes in the book, where one thing starts as something, and then we just turn it into something else. And I think this is what was the most enjoyable aspect of writing this book for us, not to stick to something that extremely traditional or very popular, but actually to give it our little touch. I think we have time for one more question, if anyone wants to ask one.
Two,
okay, time for two.
I just wanted to ask you, as I hear and as we hear about your incredible entrepreneurial approach to everything you do, and that plus your controlling instincts and drive have kept you in London. And I wondered, in terms of further expansion plans, while you are no longer 29, you've still got a lot of, room to grow. And what are your plans for expansion or thoughts?
I don't really know. There's never been a grand plan. This one thing led to another with the way I've developed, and Noam and the other business partners. We do our, Sammy, we do our things. You know, the book, we never planned to do a book, and then we did a book, and then we did another one. At the moment, I quite enjoy this sort of mixing the business and the writing. I think it's quite a nice combination, because it sort of makes our daily lives, business life, more interesting when we have a project. You know, a book takes a good 2 years for us to do, and that's something that really makes you focus. I don't know, there's probably going to be another book, but I don't know what it's going to be and what the focus will be. That's something we'll need to see. I've also done a program for Channel 4 in the UK, where I travel around the Mediterranean and discover different cuisines. That's airing in a couple of weeks back home. So that might be something I'll do more of. I'm not quite sure yet. And yeah, so these are a couple of possible avenues for growing, but we'll need to see. I think it's quite important for me not to know, because things, I think things happen when you don't plan.
Two quick ones. I know. The first one, thank you for making Plenty vegetarian, and why did you make it?
Plenty was vegetarian because I wrote a vegetarian column for The Guardian. I just compiled all those recipes together in Plenty and just added a few more. That was why it happened to be vegetarian.
And the last one is, do you cook at home?
I would lie if I said I did. I don't cook much at home. I cook when we have guests over, but I normally don't spend the evenings at home. I go out a lot, and to restaurants, to my restaurants, to other places. So at the moment, I don't
cook much at home, but I plan to domesticate myself next year and cook much more at home.
Thank you very much. You have been listening to a talk by Otam
Yotam.
Thank you. Otolenghi. Before the Commonwealth Club of California, this concludes today's program.
Shall I do the honors?
Please. Go for it. Thank you very much.